Now let's turn to how this country has developed. Chances are you've seen the works of Edward Curtis, possibly maybe not even realizing it. His are iconic, definitive photographic images of Native Americans as the 19th century turned into the 20th century. Author and New York Times journalist Timothy Egan has been looking into Edward Curtis's life, and he's written a book, Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher, The Epic Life and Immortal Photographs of Edward Curtis. Thanks for being here.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, who was he?
Well, you know, if you lived in Seattle 110 years ago, there was no better known Seattleite than Edward Curtis. You picked up your newspaper on a Sunday and there was a two-page spread, Curtis back from Southwest, where he documents snake dance. You know, he was this sort of this returning conqueror. Curtis proves elites in East Coast wrong by showing that Apache, quote, do have religion, because the conventional wisdom was they didn't have any religion. They were godless people. Curtis returns from summer weekend with president. You know, he was a consort of Teddy Roosevelt. So he was a very well-known guy, not just for his photographs, for his sort of flash and debonair and what he was trying to, and this, the audacity of what he was trying to do, which was document as many North American Indian tribes as then existed that still live somewhat by the old ways.
How did he come to that audacious idea?
You know, first it's important, Steve, to understand the man. He had a sixth grade education. He lived in a homestead shack across Puget Sound, what is now Port Orchard. A few years after he leaves the homestead shack, he's taking pictures of the elite of Seattle. So he's a very ambitious guy, 6'2", very good looking, very athletic, a mountaineer, pioneer climber on Mount Hood, led the Mazamas up Hood and Mount Rainier. And the women were required to wear bloomers is one of the things I found when he led more women to the summit of Rainier than anyone had ever done. But in very short time, he went from this absolute nobody guy, literally foraging for berries and clams, to being the premier portrait photographer in the United States. And then he takes the leap that for which he's famous. I'm sorry.
Just real quick, he's laid up with an injury because he's doing some logging, right?
Right. His dream in life was to own this little sawmill, you know, in Port Orchard.
How old is he at this point?
He's like 21. Right. And he has a terrible accident rolling one of these logs and falls and mangles his back and spends almost a year horizontal on his back with his widowed mother and four kids at home. And this sort of neighbor girl comes by who he ultimately marries, this teenage, beautiful teenage girl. But it's while he's on his back that he starts to observe the world, the outside world, and light and prisms of light and how it changes, and starts fiddling with this camera that his old man, the preacher, had brought home from the Civil War.
Just the lens.
Right, exactly. You did read the book. Very good. Good attention to detail.
Like Curtis.
That's not even in your cheat notes either. I applaud you for that. Just the lens, which he built into a camera. He later buys a 14x17. It's important to understand how he took his pictures too. Glass plate negatives are these big, cumbrous things that he schlepped around, whether it was in Mount Rainier or in the bottom of the Grand Canyon. He puts it into a 14x17 view camera, takes an image on that glass, then schleps the glass back to Seattle, where it later will be projected onto metal.
Yeah, it's an amazing technology. And Curtis saw it as an art form, in part because of how he had to interact with the image.
Exactly. And he's a fusion of two people. He started as an artist. That's why he was so famous as a portrait photographer, that he could get something out of a person. They would look at a portrait and say, my God, you captured something I never thought was there. Even if the guy is just a banker with three chins, he was able to find some. I looked at these pictures at the Rainier Club of all these bankers with three chins because he earned his living down there for a while. That's how he paid his rent when his wife kicked him out. But so that artist sensibility he brings to this documentarian sensibility, which is, oh my God, the continent's original people are disappearing, and I want to capture them before they go.
All right. There's the very famous picture of Princess Angeline. Was that... That wasn't his very first Native American picture, was it?
It actually was.
It was his first?
He said in his dying years, in his 80s, when he's telling his life story to the Seattle librarian in a series of just really interesting notes back and forth, he paid her $1 for the sitting, and this is what's interesting about that. Seattle will soon become the biggest city in the world named for a Native American, but they passed an ordinance making it illegal for a Native American to live within the city limits. They let Princess Angeline, the last surviving child of Chief Seattle, for whom the city is named, live and hang around in this tiny little shack because she's sort of a validation that their way of life is superior to this one they've just pushed out. I mean, they've got this gorgeous city. They can't believe their good fate without even having an Indian war over it. And they let this one sad little Indian, the daughter of Chief Seattle, live in the shack down on the waterfront downtown. She sells clams door to door and she does people's laundry. Curtis finds her and he sees this image in his mind of authenticity, of original Seattle, of nature and person fused. And that becomes his first picture, Princess Angela. He shoots it in 1896.
Tim Egan is our guest. He's written Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher, the epic life and immortal photographs of Edward Curtis. Tim Egan's going to be, you're going to be all over the place. When are you next? You're going to be Thursday, November 8th at the Tacoma Public Library.
Tonight at Town Hall.
And tonight at Town Hall.
7:30.
At 7:30. Let me take a break, and then I want to come back and talk about that authenticity notion. This is Weekday. Tim Egan is a Pulitzer Prize winner. His latest book tells the fascinating story of the photographer Edward Curtis. In 1900, Curtis set himself the task of photographing Native Americans from across North America in a project that turned into a lifelong vocation, obsession, a project that worked on his health and his mind and his family. But in the end, he finished it in 20 volumes. We'll get to that in a minute about how he sold those. But mm-hmm. Let's talk about authenticity.
Sure.
Princess Evangeline, Angeline, mm-hmm. if you want to change your name. That picture, he got a few pictures of her.
16.
Page 16.
Page 16, yeah.
He got a few pictures of her, but the one that he liked wasn't the first one. He got one that made her look a little, I don't know, I think you wrote that she looked a little nicer.
Right. He wanted to capture, as I said, that withering glare, that screw you look, because she was carrying rocks around in her dress because the little boys, the little Denny kids and stuff were all throwing rocks at her. They called her the hag, the shrew, the old crone. They would wait after school, throw rocks at her. And so she carried rocks as well. He knew that. He always understood context before he took his picture. So he wanted to get that look of, you've taken everything from me, but I've still got something.
Right, so
same with Chief Joseph.
You knew I was going to Chief Joseph. You knew I was going there. So
chapter two, at the end of chapter.
How does that one relate to the Chief Joseph picture? Because Chief Joseph picture is more created.
Right. Well, no, he shoots two versions of Chief Joseph. One is with a headdress. One is without. End of chapter three is where the picture is.
No, that's right.
Right.
You see me jumping through the book.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Okay. He shoots two pictures of Chief Joseph in his studio. Again, let's understand context. It's 1903. Joseph will be dead within a year. He's living as a virtual prisoner of war on a reservation in Colville. And the people of Seattle bring him over to go to a Husky game. They parade him around at this football game, and they write these incredibly patronizing story. Indian watches football game, grunts. They said, what did you think of a football game? He said, I saw a lot of white people almost hurt each other. So Curtis understands that Joseph is here because he wants to get his homeland back. He's going to give a speech before a big crowd in his native language, and he wants to get his homeland back. That's why he's doing it. And so when he sits him down to take the picture, he alone understands the plight of the Nez Perce. He's researched the history. He's gone to Eastern Washington. And so the context is of this guy who's portrayed as this Indian Napoleon, but actually is more of a wise person, a person who understood, you know, that he'd lost everything and still wanted to get it back.
So the rap on Curtis has been Curtis exploited the natives. This is the most egregious rap. He exploited the natives. He forced them to wear costumes that they were no longer wearing, and he paid them in order to get sales of these pictures.
Well, first of all, that rap doesn't come from the natives themselves. They appreciate what Curtis did. And I went to almost every reservation that Curtis went to, and believe me, this guy is incredibly appreciated. His pictures are everywhere. More importantly, Steve, he captured audio recordings, more than 10,000 different wax cylinder recordings of songs and language that otherwise would have left the planet. So they appreciate him for preserving their culture at a time when it was illegal to preserve that culture. I mean, we'd passed laws making it illegal for them to do these worships. Now, the rap on him, he never denied. This is revisionism. He never, ever denied in any contemporary essay that he paid people. He spent a lot of time with them, and he wanted to pay them for their time. He was a portrait artist taking portraits, so he paid his subjects. He also would say sometimes, if he arrived in a reservation, he'd spent months there, and he would sometimes spend years before he would take a picture just to get it right. do you have any of the clothes that your father wore? They would have overalls on, or they would have, stiff collared dress shirts. And he'd say, do you have any headdresses? Do you have any buckskin? And they'd say, well, yes, we do back here. And he said, well, that's what I'd like to shoot, is the picture that shows you as your father's people were. And then he asked many of them, which would you prefer, a modern clothes or the clothes of your grandfather? And invariably, except for near the end, when he got to the Comanche, where you'll see pictures with dress shirts and ties, they chose those things. So he never this was a false thing. Also, if you went to Scotland tomorrow and went around taking a photographic, epic of the clans of Scotland, and you asked somebody to put on a kilt, that's what he did, a family kilt. These are family clothing items that he asked people to wear for his portrait.
How do you view these pictures today? What are they?
I love, and I think most people agree with me on this, the portraits more than the sort of, pictures of people reenacting a battle or grazing their horses by the water or doing a ritual, a dance. The portraits themselves, and this is what the native people say, they show a humanity in the faces. And this is what was so revolutionary about Seattle's Edward Curtis was he was the first person to really show human beings in these faces. They were stick figures. The idea was you were either noble savage or cigar store Indians. And he showed human beings in the faces. They laugh. They're smug. They, look away, in really awful gazes. They do, especially near the end when he goes to the north and finds people living without missionary influences. They're all smiling and laughing in those pictures.
Curtis did not like the missionaries or the Indian agents, the government agents.
His worst, he had two enemies. One was time itself, because it was robbing him of these subjects. They were dying at a rather, 235,000 natives. That's what the census counted in all the United States in 1900, down from 20 million. His other enemies were the missionaries, because if he got to a reservation, say the Blackfeet in Montana, and he saw the crucifix in the church, he knew he was doomed. Because Indian policy then was to take little kids out of the tribes, put them into these boarding schools, and scrub the Indian out of them, send them back with haircuts, new clothes, and new religion. And they said, this wasn't my line. They said, we want to wash the Indian out of them. So he finally, near the end of his life, gets to the far north in 1927, north of the Arctic Circle, and he finds no missionaries at all. And he finds happy people, prosperous people, living, in his mind, authentically.
I love the picture of that Nunavik woman.
I do, too.
He takes it at the very end. Now, what about, sorry, so here's this, this is one of some of his first pictures, the Piegan Dandy, mm-hmm. It's called. This is from Montana. How does this guy compare, this portrait of this guy, compare to, what was the name of the writer who was writing all those dime novels? May?
Well, yeah, Carl May, it's pronounced.
Carl May.
It was a German writer who wrote incredibly popular novels about Indians having never seen an Indian. And that was very common. When Curtis went back to the Smithsonian and spoke to their Indian experts, they said the Indians have no religion. They said, how do you know? He goes, well, we've never been there, but we've been told that they have no religion. Most people had never experienced it. He went full immersion for 30 years. He became a member of the Snake Dance Society in Hopi land in Arizona. Took him 10 years until he could go into the pit and handle the snakes himself so he could understand what a snake dance warrior is. So unlike Carl May, who wrote about Indians from Germany, Curtis photographed Indians after spending months, years, decades with them. He understood the culture.
He understood
the myth.
You read his letters. You read his short biography that he wrote, autobiography that he wrote. You read lots of letters, and mm-hmm. people were asking him questions after he'd fallen into obscurity for 20 years before he died. People were finding him and writing him letters. Mm-hmm. What drove him? What was his motivation? I mean, 30 years to work on this project, to get 20 volumes. And
it broke him, too. As you mentioned, it cost him his marriage. It cost him, he lost his copyright to what is arguably the greatest book project ever done by a single American. It's compared to John James Audubon's Birds of America. It was compared to the King James Bible. The thing sold for $3,000 in 1910 to get a single volume. So, I mean, this was a huge, huge achievement just in terms of bookmaking. And put aside the context, the myths, the recordings, the pictures, just the achievement of the technology of the bookmaking, not to mention the film he did as well, which was Breakthrough. First real native documentary film.
In the land of the Wakandas.
Yeah, using an all-native cast on location. No one had ever done that. Indians were Italians with face paint. So what drove him? He was a poor kid. He had the insecurity of self-made men. No, they don't really trust me. The bastards don't understand me. The Smithsonian, the elites back east, the universities were always after him. They didn't think. In fact, his anthropology has really held up, particularly in the section on the Crow in Montana, which is used as a field study right now. It's the best thing ever done on the Crow because he spent so much time there. And his best friend, who was later murdered, this Crow translator, really helped him with the Crow. Upshaw was the guy's name, the guy who was educated at the Indian school and came back and was conflicted. So, but what drove him? I think it. My conclusion, having read all the stuff, is that it's no more complex than what drives any great artist or writer. He wanted to do something lasting and immortal. He said all the time to his buddy Ed Meany, after whom many Meany sites in the University of Washington are named. That Meany was his closest friend and the person who understood Indians as much as he did. He said of his subjects, "I simply want to make them live forever." And he wanted, in that sense, his own immortality. He wanted to do something great and lasting. And sometimes he would just feel like nobody appreciated him, and he'd be in a hotel room in New York, and Meany would write him, you know, "You'll be long dead, but people will be reading about you. People will be looking at your pictures. You will outlive this."
You know, people say he created museum pieces, that he froze them in time. What's your response to that?
Yeah, I think he did. I think that was his goal, too, because the time was slipping away. Now, as the authenticity, whatever you want to call it, of the original tribe started to slip, by the time Curtis is in Oklahoma in the 1920s, which is the designated Indian territory for a long time, we dumped all the tribes from the east there after the Indian Removal Act forced all Indians to move east of the Mississippi. He doesn't find anyone living in the old ways. They're all, you know, in overalls and dress shirts and short hair. What does he shoot? Short hair, overalls. There's a picture of a Comanche. They were the Lord of the Plains. Everyone feared the Comanche. That's Quinault Parker's tribe. They wailed on the Texas Rangers. They wailed on the Apache. They ruled a whole swath of the Southern Plains. And now they're living in a postage stamp sized reservation. And what does he shoot? He shoots a picture of a guy with short hair and a tie. So to go back to frozen in time, he froze the time that was going on. I mean, by the time he's in the 20s, he's freezing that time there.
You say something pretty funny was that though Curtis disappeared from consciousness, Native Americans didn't. And in part, they had Curtis's, the work he had done on capturing songs and writing down the songs and the recordings, which is amazing. He carried that recorder with him in the 1900s.
That's one of the things that blew me away about Curtis, and I don't think most people know, is he didn't just write captions for these pictures. There are 2,200 pages of text in the 20 volumes of his magnum opus, The North American Indian. And in those 2,200 pages are long, detailed stories of creation myths, of diet, of who they fought and who they loved, stories of clans and bands and tribes that no one had researched before, no one had researched with such exhaustive detail. And then those recordings. You can hear now some of the songs that Curtis recorded, and there's no substitute for the actual audio.
You've heard them?
Oh, yes. They're just incredible. They're extraordinary. And then he did a movie with an all-Native cast, too, by the way, as I mentioned.
Which, as you say, was restored at some point.
And now it's hailed as a pioneer breakthrough that it was.
I just real quick before I'm out of time. So to get these volumes printed and published, to get some support for his work, which the story I understand, he doesn't get any money for it. He goes to J.P. Morgan.
Right.
He gets some support from J.P. Morgan, but he has to sell basically subscriptions to rich people.
Right. So Curtis his portrait business is not supporting his great idea. So he ends up going hand to hat to all these rich people. Roosevelt and E.H. Harriman have introduced him to some of them. And he's not getting much money. He finally ends up with the richest banker in the United States, J.P. Morgan, who's the de facto, you know, Federal Reserve when we didn't have a Federal Reserve. And Morgan grants him $75,000 over 5 years, which is enough to fund his field staff, his translators. Remember, he has up to 30 people on his payroll at any one time. It's not just this guy going around alone.
Right. He has people helping him write it.
Right,
write great it, writers
edit
working it, with
technicians. But Curtis, two things. Curtis works for free, which breaks him. And ultimately, he ends up to mortgage this thing. Morgan gives him $2.5 million, and Curtis gives up his copyright. So he owns nothing in 1930 when he's done with the last volume.
And then the Depression comes, and Morgan, and just what happened? What does Morgan do with that?
Well,
copyright?
They sell the complete collection of Edward S. Curtis, which there then was about 50 of these individual volumes. Keep in mind, one volume can go for almost $2 million today. The 50 of them, all the copper plates, all the recordings, they sell it to this Boston bookseller for $1,000. And this guy, Laureate was his name, dies shortly thereafter, like a year after purchasing it, and it rots in a basement until the 1970s.
It's a great story. I like it. And and you were in the Rainier Club, and you said all these pictures that are in the Rainier Club, a lot of them are done by Curtis to sort of pay his dues, including the portrait of Teddy Roosevelt's hanging there?
Yes. The Rainier Club has become, by default, one of the great Curtis museums in the world. Why? Because when Curtis's marriage broke up and his wife kicked him out, he moved into the Rainier Club. I saw the little bunk upstairs, the little room where he stayed. So while Curtis is housing in the Rainier Club, you know, more than 10 years, he tells everyone, you can meet me at the Rainier Club. He has to pay his rent. How does he pay his rent? He gives up some of his masterpieces, including the Roosevelt portrait, which Curtis took while summering at the summer White House at Sagamore Hill. Roosevelt later said it was the best picture anyone ever took of him, and he uses it in his autobiography as the main picture. It shows a soft Roosevelt, no big teeth, no warrior. It shows a more thoughtful Roosevelt.
Yes.
That's what the ability that Curtis had. He could find a side to a person that others could not.
One of the great things about it is that, you know, you can Google Curtis photographs, and there's so many on the web to look at, and there's a lot in this book as well. Short Nights of the Shadow Catcher, The Epic Life and Immortal Photographs of Edward Curtis, written by Pulitzer Prize winner Tim Egan, who will be at the town hall tonight. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Steve.
This is Weekday.
It.